Greetings, Raise Community. Brent coming in live with today's guest, Tom Farrell, who serves as Senior Vice President of Advancement at the University of Rochester. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you, Brent. Good to be here.
Well, it is great for you to be here because, as you know more than anyone, I've been working on getting this visit for quite a while, and I'm really excited to be able to share your story with our community and get to know you a little bit better here today.
Yeah, and as I was saying earlier, I really admire the fact that you do this, and I think it's very effective. It's a great idea for everybody, and so, you know, I'm psyched to be on with you.
All right, well, here we go. I have been really enjoying learning more about not only the professional journey of leaders in our field, as I was saying, we've done about, you know, we're coming up on 200 of these episodes, but also the personal journey. You know, who are you? Where'd you come from? Very few people were, you know, 12 years old saying, how can I become an advancement leader someday? And so why don't you take me back to, let's say, junior year of high school? Where were you? Who were you? And what led you to the University of Rochester?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, people say that about falling into the profession, and I guess that's true. I actually have a little bit of an issue with that characterization, because I there's something about it, it strikes me the wrong way, you know, that, and it for me, and I think it might resonate with you, it gets into this, a little bit of this sort of deprofessionalization of our field that frankly I'm concerned about. So I just want to throw that out there because I think that's in the spirit of your program.
I'm going to make a note of that. We'll come back to it. And I do think that was probably more reflective of the way things were, but there have been massive efforts to professionalize it, but B, create real pre-professional on-ramps by way of CASE, Advancement Leadership Lab. There's a bunch of ways that that is changing. So yeah, sorry if I...
You didn't say that. I did. But anyways, my background, I grew up in Rochester. My dad had his doctorate from the University of Rochester in 1968. He was in the counseling field, and he used to bring neighborhood kids around in like our living room and do brainstorming sessions when we were like 6 years old. And so he was a very progressive I wouldn't call him really an academic because he had a lot of different sides to him, but that was a part of it. And then my mom was a high school teacher for 27 years in English. She actually had Renee Fleming as one of her students, interestingly, but who's a prominent U of R graduate from our Eastman School. So, education was a part of it, but it was a different time back then. It was the 70s when I grew up. And I lived in the country and ended up going to the University of Rochester. I had a history in political science, double major undergraduate. And we used to call that our batteries not included degree. I'm not sure we should say that these days, but ended up in the financial services space. So I was a broker.
Dive into the next step. Like, did you love college? Was it okay? What was your, what were the highlights? And
I had a non-traditional.
The battery not included path, like where, you know, how did you start to narrow down the next step?
I had a non-traditional college experience. There are a lot of reasons for that. But I spent, a good part of that time in my life doing other things. I was a gas station attendant. I was a Mason's laborer. I worked in a clothing store. I was a janitor. I learned a lot of things in my life that weren't directly related to college, even though I always had an understanding and a propensity to higher education and to deeper thinking about things. But, a lot of me at that time was formed by these other experiences.
More about some of the memories, because not a lot of people have done the gas station role or the janitor role or the Mason role. So that, definitely indicates that you've, gotten the hands dirty in ways that, many haven't. Just whatever you're comfortable sharing, but what are some of the memories, experiences that you developed or characteristics maybe that were honed?
I think the thing for me was an exposure, which I know a lot of people have, but to the other side of the world of our society. It's easier for me to think about and reflect upon now than maybe in the moment. But some tough characters, some people that maybe nowadays we would, categorize as people who aren't, fully understanding of the value of higher education, that kind of thing. Doesn't mean, and I certainly understood this at that point in my life, that they weren't whip smart, smarter than me, and brought different things to the table. One of my favorite sayings is from Will Rogers, which is all, I'll change it. His original statement was all men are ignorant only on different subjects. So nowadays I would say all people are ignorant only on different subjects. And so, I'm not sure I want Einstein to, change the brakes on my car. And I'm not sure he could do it. Is that kind of thing, which I take into my work now, sort of a practicality, a sense of how people are, that people of all different stripes have tremendous value to bring to our society. And so I really believe that it means a lot to me.
Well, it sounds like you developed a really strong sense of empathy, and I feel like empathy is one of the, most critical parts of this work for sure, but also just one of the ways that empathy is honed by is legitimately getting a window into not just a quick snapshot into somebody else's life, but really when you're shoulder to shoulder at the garage, or you're shoulder to shoulder laying the bricks. I think you feel that a lot more. I was a first generation college student, and my first job was catching chickens in a chicken farm at night. And it was me and a group of my buddies, and we'd race against the buddies on the other side of the truck. And it's funny now. I don't know. You see a chicken, and it just you think a lot different than maybe without that experience. And so on one hand, you're getting, let's call it, a really kind of blue collar exposure. You're advancing through college, and then at the same time, needing to decide what is your first step.
Yeah, I think my as I said, my parent, my dad was a college professor, but I was doing other things. And I guess my point from a business perspective nowadays would be trying to hone in on and pay attention to the difference we can make in society, and recognizing that the society that our society has a very broad scope, and that the work we do is not only, locally based, but it's nationally and globally based. And trying to put ourselves in the context of broader societal issues and items and things in a way that is also consistent with the idea we're trying to make things better. Because when I grew up, that was part of it too. My old man was a big fan of JFK. He was 21 years old. He was an Irish, kid, and he was in the duck blind when Kennedy, got the, won the presidency. And, they were into that. And so that, reflected on me when I was young. And those people were serious politicians who were trying to, you could look at it in a lot of different ways, but the political environment was different. The social environment was different. And I think some of that, got into my head.
And so, as you started to think about your first professional step, where'd you land?
I mean, I was looking for a job. And so I, back to that batteries comment, but I ended up getting a job in working for Dean Witter Reynolds, which was a brokerage outfit. It's not around anymore. That's what formed the real strength of my advancement career, because what they did was, you worked for them for 4 months, and the 4 months that you started with them, you were studying in the office for the Series 7, Series 3, Series 63 exams, that would register you as a broker. But the real thing was that they then sent us to New York City. We worked in the World Trade Center on the 63rd floor and put us through six weeks of sales training. And, you know, I was thinking about this morning, you know, 6 weeks, you know, it was awesome. We had so much fun. I can't believe how much I loved being in New York in those days with those people. There's 100 of us. And, you know, but 6 weeks, that's pretty significant sales training. We don't do that in our shop, in our business. I mean, we'll talk about professional development in a little while, I'm sure. But, you know, these were top salespeople from around the country for a pretty big operation. Dean Witter knew that basically four people would survive out of that class, 100 people. And they knew four were going to make it after 2 years. Unbelievable when you think about it. But the point was that the production.
Did you all know that 4 out of 100 would make it?
They told us. You know, it was sort of a challenge, you know. You know, they wanted people to succeed, but that's the way it was. I don't know what the real numbers ended up turning out to be, but the point on that was that the production numbers of those four were going to cover the cost of the program.
Tell me about, give me the 60-second or 6-minute elevator pitch on Dean Witter training right now. I mean, walk me through it, 6 weeks, because on one hand, it is extensive. And on the other hand, it's a blink of an eye. You're still thinking about it, you know, these years later. So it means it made a big impression on you. But if you could just lift the most valuable nuggets from those 6 weeks and drop it into every advancement shop in America, what would it look like?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, a big takeaway was preparation. So business planning, which is a pretty basic idea and not, limited to sales activity. Another piece of it was dealing with objections. A third piece of it was the basic pipeline nature of sales, which I think is absolutely critical. So I learned in that program, you know, you do 100 dials, 100 outreaches, whatever it is. There was no email at that time, but 100 dials. You'd get 10 contacts. Out of 10 contacts, visits, 10 contacts, you get 3 visits. And out of 3 visits, you get 1 account. So the basics of it are you do the math. If you can do that, you will build a book of business and do some of the other things, the product knowledge, et cetera, and you will succeed.
And what do you think, ballpark, the value of that account might have been, recognizing that in that business, you know, similar to advancement, it's not all about, you know, the one-time close. It's let's secure the relationship, and then we start building the assets together over time, right?
Yeah, totally. 100%.
I mean, if you're trying to secure somebody to give you $5,000 to invest in stocks, or was it $50,000, or was it, you know, $500?
The name of the game was to capture assets.
Okay.
That was an early look at the business. That's what everybody does now. It's all about capturing assets.
Yeah.
So if I can capture assets, I'm going to get a percentage of that. And I'm going to win.
Yep.
And it's the same for us. You know, when I talk about the business, the advancement business, I've broken it into 5 pieces. It's not a singular piece. It's 5 pieces. One piece is the large gift fundraising piece, major gifts and principal gifts fundraising. The second piece is the annual giving and leadership annual giving game. The third piece is the engagement piece, which includes alumni relations and other constituent relations activity, as well as stewardship, communication, special events, that kind of thing. The fourth piece is organizational management. And the last piece is partnerships. And partnerships relates to volunteer management and external partnerships, as well as internal partnerships. And that we call those CBAs, core business areas. And the reason I do that is to create a rationale and a structure to understand the business. Because I work with people who don't get it. And I'm just being direct. And it'd be helpful if people understand our business. And I think from the Dean Witter perspective, The ideas around the fundamentals of sales, capturing resources, relationship management, all that stuff, they did train us on that. And when I came into the business at the U of R, my first job, you're not getting that.
Well, here's the thing, though, is I feel like, I mean, this is such a fun conversation.
Yeah.
Because I think in this sector, we have spent so, if you think about like the engagement pillar of Dean Witter's strategy, the engagement pillar, right? It was, let's call that marketing, right? It was billboards, it was ads, it was brochures you were given.
Right.
They weren't inviting 50,000 people who used to live at Dean Witter to come spend 2 days reconnecting with their amazing experience at Dean Witter. Like the engagement there is so much worse. I mean, and by the way, they've got 10, 20, 50 competitors that all want those assets that have the same relatively weak or non-existent connection with the same leads that you're calling. And so I look at this sector and it's like, man, we've got 100,000 plus people that are so much warmer than the absolute, like the coldest lead in advancement is warmer than the warmest lead you ever got at Dean Witter. But I do think at times what we're really missing is the simple thing you just outlined, which is it's Thursday, March 14th. I'm going to make 100 calls. I'm going to get 10 contacts. I'm going to get 3 visits and I'm going to get a proposal out of that. And if I did that even 200 days a year at, $50,000 average gift, which I don't think is crazy. That's $1 million a year. Done.
Right. No, it's exactly, you're right. And everything you said is correct. I'll just throw in one little sort of memory of that. But when I was with Dean Witter, Sears bought them. Sears bought Dean Witter. And Sears opened up shops for Dean Witter people in their stores. And, this is, we've all seen these people, right? Anyways, there were people. So I'll just finish this up. But at our operation at Dean Witter, there were probably 30 brokers in my office. There were a couple offices in Rochester. There were 30, 35 brokers, something like that. And every month they would run the production figures. And everybody would see the production figures. And Farrell would be like 35. I had no production. I was young. I didn't really know what I was doing. I couldn't pull it off. And then there'd be the guys at the top. And you'd see them sitting in their offices, like sitting with their feet up. The manager would come in. They'd like say, go away. The manager had no, because they were the producers. And it was just a funny experience. And I guess, what was my point? My point is that, you knew what you had to do. The question was, could you get it done? And, and my final point was when I left Dean Witter, I decided I was going to be a teacher because summer's off sounded good and so on. So I left Dean Witter and I went back to the U of R to take my master's degree in higher ed. And so I was going to be a teacher. I student taught for a year, half a year, whatever that program was. And, and that was a lot harder than I thought it was going to be. And that was another thing I learned early on in my, that being a teacher is hard if you want to be good at it. And you got to have a passion for it. And I didn't really. And then I full-time subbed. I was looking for a job. And this is how I got into advancement. I had the sales and financial background from my brokerage experience. And I had the higher ed piece from the master's degree. And I applied for a class program officer position at the University of Rochester. I was in Rochester at the time. And I got the job. And that's how I got into the field. And it turned out that ultimately I had these very strong sales capabilities, which were honed through that program. And I also was very good on the organizational side. And so the two of those things sort of carried me through my career.
And so take me a little bit through the journey. I know that you spent some time, you started at the alma mater and then spent some time in the Chicago and Illinois area. Just, take me through some of the highlights when you reflect on your career to date.
Yeah, I spent 4.5 years at Rochester. We were in a campaign at the time, $175 million at the basically the undergraduate, art sciences and engineering piece, which was the second largest, core sub campaign number in the country at that time. I learned a lot. The guy who was our annual giving guy had come in from Georgetown, so he had a model on the class side.
Who is that?
His name was Mark Newman. He owned a restaurant on the side. He was a piece of work. But he was a go-getter. He brought me in once because I was sort of an arrogant kind of young person. And he brings me in, he says, "Tom," I've been there for 6 months. He said, "Tom, you can't be a vice president in 6 months." He says, "You got to have some gray hairs," and now I do. But that was another learning experience for me because I was a hot shot, thought I knew a lot. And 6 months.
I think that's what they say about Gen Z today. It sounds like you might have a little Gen Z in you, Tom.
Right, or people just aren't that different. So, anyways, I did that, and we were in a campaign. I had the campaign experience, I had the class experience. They sent me into the field, in that stint. And I had to go. The theory was I would go see people, and on the first ask, I'd ask them for between $10,000 and $25,000. First ask.
Okay.
I got thrown out of a couple offices, actually thrown out.
Tell me more about that. Come on, we haven't had full on, bouncing situations yet.
It was so fun. Well, and it was just very quick. I'm in this guy's office. I'm doing my job. I'm going to ask for the gift, and he's like, "Don't ask me for a gift." I'm like, "Well, and he's like, "No, don't do it. Don't do it." And I'm like, "Well, I have to do it. I'm going to ask you for a gift of," he's like, "Don't do it." And I said, "A gift of $10,000 to $25,000. And he's like, "You got to get out." And I told a headhunter that story once. He's like, "Don't tell that story."
Yeah, I'm so glad you're telling me that story. I feel like I'm
So
getting like this is an episode of The Office, and it was
yeah.
like Dwight and Michael Scott talking, and like,
Oh God.
and Dwight just had to get it out there.
It's so funny. But we closed some gifts. But so anyways, I did that. And then I had another good experience. I went to University of Buffalo, and I led the law school development program there, which was a great experience to be at a public and to do the unit piece. I have many stories from that as well, which I'm not going to tell. And then I got my, I guess you could say my big break, which was I was recruited to go to Dartmouth. I didn't really know it at the time, but I applied for the major gifts director job, and they offered me the gift planning director job, which was another break because it gave me that whole estate planning piece, and I mean that was incredible. And just two quick stories on that: when I got the offer, I was talking to the headhunter, and they tried to retain me at Buffalo, and they were going to give me enrollment management, alumni relations, and keep me there. And I was talking to the headhunter. She's like, "Let's see, UB or Dartmouth." And so we decided to go for the Dartmouth thing. And that whole, and I'm very sensitive to this issue, but I spent 15 years in the Ivy League, group. And just a quick story, I was at UB Law School, and we were at a big conference. There's only 180 law schools in the United States, and we were at a conference at Jackson Hole. And I'll actually say it, Scott Nichols was up there, and he was presenting to us as law school people, and he was presenting about closing professorships and how they have this great program they had developed closing professorships at Harvard Law School, and it was some sort of match thing or something. And I remember sitting there and thinking, that's nice for you to say that. You've got, like 150 partners at White and Case. UB had like one partner at White and Case and a few other partners at the major firms. It sort of bugged me. And it's to suggest that people who are in these, very rarefied programs are, quote, better fundraisers than the rest of us, I find, frankly, pretty problematic. And it goes back to where we started in terms of my background and so on. And I did it for 15 years. I get it. and they're wonderful places. But to suggest that there's some differentiation based on their production subject to their prospect pool, I'm not buying it. We all have work to do. The people at the community colleges, the people at the regional institutions, they're breaking their butts to do what they can with their prospect pools. And that doesn't make me a better fundraiser than them.
Well, I think what you're highlighting is, you know, production is relative. And right. My sense is that if effectively all engagement in fundraising activities were to stop for a year at Harvard or Dartmouth, let's say, Brown is my alma mater.
Yeah.
For sure, results would go down, but also for sure, tens or hundreds of millions of dollars would be raised regardless due to the momentum, the history, the estate planning, et cetera, as you've just highlighted. There is a certain element of like inbound philanthropy that happens in that sphere, if you will, that, you know, probably doesn't happen at a regional public. And so I think it just means that the question is, relative to our capacity and prospect pool, are we operating as effectively as we can be? And I think, based on what I've seen, if we could apply the Dean Witter model at Harvard or UB or pick your community college and have a group of people come in, get 6 weeks of intensive training, and then clearly get a list, make 100 calls a day, I think production would go up at Harvard. I think it would go up at UB.
Harvard and these programs, they have very sophisticated programs because the volume and the history and the scale that they deal with requires them to do so. So when I went to Dartmouth, I remember laughing because the phone would ring. Like, what, the phone would ring? They're calling me to give me money. I was like, whoa, this is incredible.
Across the advancement sector, gift planning is probably the place where the phone would ring the most.
Right.
Is that
true? Totally true. Totally true. I don't want to give people the wrong idea, because the other piece of this is that, you know, I was at Dartmouth and then I went to Penn, and I was at Penn for 10 years. We had to work very hard to get the results we sought at those places. It wasn't like people were, dropping out of the trees. There was some of that. But the work is very similar. I guess I was just, overreacting to sort of the brand equity and prospect pool differentiation.
I would imagine, though, part of the art of that world, tell me about it, is somebody calls and says, hey, I'd like to talk to somebody about estate planning, and they've already done their work. They've talked to their family. They've got something in mind. The easy thing to do would be somebody saying, hey, I've got $500,000 earmarked, and can you help me? Mm-hmm. I bet it gets a lot more fun when you think about, how do I turn that 500 into 5 million? Yeah. And how do we start a longer term stewardship path where, they're walking into the store thinking they want, X, and really, there's a bigger vision to put in front of them.
I think that's right. And I think the difference is, from these various institutions, is you have more to work with. And again, that's not a skill issue. That's an opportunity item that's powerful and wonderful. And they're great places. And, people consistently criticize, for instance, Harvard for their quote wealth. And my response to that is, until Harvard is, all their operations are fully endowed, then I don't begrudge them a dollar that they raise. And I remember Ruth Simmons, who was the former president at Brown, told me once, she said that, that's all good, but there's so much we don't know. And that's a small set of words, but it's an important one. The purpose of the institutions is to seek knowledge and understanding, and that we don't know anything about anything at the end of the day. And so no matter what we're already doing at Rochester, at Harvard, or Monroe Community College, whatever it is, there's so much more, that we could do.
Well, you've already told me about getting thrown out of an office, which is just great. That's going to go down in the highlights. But when you think about your career, other just really poignant memories, and I'll give you some examples, right? An absolute fiasco of a trip that just couldn't have gone worse, right? Off the rails, travel, whatever it may be. Or really visceral donor reactions like the one you've already shared. Or on the upside, you know, really unique situations where you were able to take a negative experience or a negative reaction and actually bring them on the journey into a positive. So just, you know, when you're out with friends and they say, hey, you know, all you do is deal with people your whole career, Tom, you must have seen some real, you know, some real gems. You know, what comes to mind?
Yeah, I'm not a huge war story guy, but, you know, I try to live a little bit in the moment. I think, you know, the big thing, and I will tell a couple, but you know, the big thing that I'm on, and it goes back to where we started, is basically what I call an account executive approach.
Okay.
And I'm trying to move more towards, you know, the sales thing has been a loaded word in our business. I think those days are over, frankly. It's a sales job. And I think the idea of the account executive is that I've got the Brent Grinna account, and my job is as prospect manager, let's just take the major gifts piece, is to maximize the potential philanthropy and engagement advocacy that you can bring to the table for Rochester. That's my job. And, you know, I need to involve other partners, whatever resources I can bring to bear to maximize your account over time. And I think people taking ownership for that idea in my role, if I were a major gift person, and recognize, okay, how many accounts do I have? And how many accounts do I need to maximize my role in this organization, in this mission, et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, when I think about war stories, I mean, one of my favorites is we got $100 million gift from Bill Granger when I was at Illinois. And my favorite story, I didn't know Bill Granger well. I was president of the foundation, chief development officer. And he called me to thank me. He was like 87 at the time. And I remember my secretary came and said, you know, Bill Granger's on the phone. I'm like, okay. And there he is. And he's from the day, you know, he's like, you know, Mr. Farrell, I just want to say thank you for, I'm like, really? And so it's just so awesome. And, so I think, you know, the things that have gone wrong, I mean, there's so many. A story I'm telling recently, well, privately telling it, but, you know, Ray Perlman at Penn, who named the medical school for $225 million. You know, Penn was after Ray Perlman for 35 years. You know, and they were great to us. The Perlman family is a great, you know, benefactor, but not at that level. But they did it. He was 92, I think, when he made that gift. It's sort of an interesting thing to think about. And that account, that relationship was worth everything they put into it.
I absolutely love the stories. I love the account executive model. Obviously, you know, a huge part of our work at Evertrue is how do we translate commercial sales world and then modify it. And I do think the difference is that for a lot of commercial sales representatives, the way that they would think about their work, I'll flip it on you. Mm-hmm. Tom is the SVP of advancement at the University of Rochester. I manage the Rochester account. Therefore, it's my job to build a relationship with Tom, who is in that seat. Mm-hmm. But then Tom decides next week to go to Dean Witter. Mm-hmm. Well, okay, who's the next person in the seat? Because that's my account. And that's the big difference in this world is the account never changes. You will have the account for 70 years in some cases.
Right.
And the way you think about managing a 70-year relationship, it is absolutely different than I am responsible for whomever is in the seat at the University of Rochester.
Right. It's a great point. It's absolutely true. It's a mind-blowing concept, really. And really, you know, that,
what other business has 70-year relationships? What other business has to sell a product, or in your case, a mission, that could be $5 as your senior class gift, or 500 million or a billion? And you could be a 22-year-old customer or a 92-year-old customer and everything in between. It's really what makes it so challenging for this sector, is because most businesses would say, this is our persona. It's somebody who looks like this and reads that, and they make this much money and they live in these zip codes, and go follow that persona. And your persona is everyone.
Right. And so much of that is out of your hand, out of your hands. So
and those seeds were planted 70 or 60 or 50 years ago, right?
Or, you know, the place, you know, has a crisis, or, you know, there's all the external issues. You know, take the Israel Gaza situation, or freedom of speech, or et cetera. You know, it's, so these things are, you know, impacting, which would happen in your business too, but not so much. You know, it's, we're associated with a narrative that the advancement person obviously has to respond and react to, but also has to manage through. The thing that I'm into on that, and that's where the Ivy League and other places are very good at it, and other places too, on the National Liberal Arts Colleges, lots of places, is the cultural nature of the basis, or the foundation of the relationship with the individual. You know, they used to call it cradle to grave, right, Brent? The idea is, and if you go to Dartmouth, you know, there is this, what I call a culture of ownership. And what we're trying to do at Rochester is, we have a culture of ownership, but we need to extend it. And to every stakeholder, whether it's the janitor, or the president, or whatever. And the analogy I use is that, if you're in a hotel room and you look up and you see a leak in the ceiling, you may tell the manager, you may not. You may just go get in your car and go to the plane. If there's a leak in your house's ceiling, you're canceling everything and you're dealing with that. That's ownership. And we need people to, you know, have a mission-based sense of ownership that we also need to reciprocate, so that every piece of your relationship, people do get what you say, you know, the brand of Rochester, or Evertrue, you know, speaks to me.
Yeah. Well, I think, yeah, I had Fritz from Johns Hopkins recently on the podcast. It was my first time really, you know, spending time with him. And he really talked a lot about the idea of the investor mindset, right? The evolution of, it's not just a gift, it's an investment.
Yeah, right.
And obviously there's a lot of work going into being able to connect the dots between not just $1 million, but $1 million buys X impact, you know, the 100 million buys Y impact. And sometimes, you know, if it's a building, you know, that's more intuitive, because, you know, bricks cost money and the beams cost money and the plans cost money. But I think the sector has absolutely gotten a lot better at taking somewhat nebulous or intangible impact areas and making them much more concrete, so that the investor knows what they're buying.
Yeah. And for me, this goes back to professional development, and, if you will, sales training. You know, so you talk about the investor mentality. That's something that's been around for a long time. You know, Fritz is a very senior, seasoned guy. He's seen it all. The trick is getting, you know, Fritz's kind of mentality and sophistication in the hands or the minds of the regular officer. And, you know, so what do we do to walk people through the development of that ability to take into the field? And so it's one thing for the investor mentality, you know, a couple PowerPoint slides maybe, but you got to work with people to get to that. You and I would both have to work on that. We'd get it after a while, but so what we do here, and I did this at Penn, and some of it comes from Paul Edwards, who is a trainer from the day, but a professional development program that's built around product knowledge, skills development, and confidence building. And the confidence building piece is basically the repetition and modeling of the actual activity. So what's your product knowledge, and is that defined? And then what's the skill set? And so product knowledge skills would probably include something like investor mentality, how to articulate, promote, develop, utilize that kind of theory.
Are people still getting thrown out of offices? Or, I mean, I'm thinking more about the character building aspects of having some of those experiences. It builds, you know, thick skin. And then on the other hand, having experiences where the persistence pays off and the Perlmans get there over time. Like, is that happening, or given?
Yeah,
a vision?
I think the field works probably better now.
I think there's an element of, like, if somebody on the team isn't getting thrown out of the office once in a while, we're probably not pushing hard enough.
Yeah, that's an extreme example.
Not literally getting thrown
I'm
out.
Not sure if I went back, you know, if I would do it that way. I was trying to do my job.
Right.
I think what you and I are saying, and I think we're in complete agreement upon, and I'm sure most people who watch this would be in agreement. The success I've had in my career has been the result of my ability to keep my eye on the ball about being external. That's why I'm where I am today. I never have lost sight, and I beat myself up on it every day, that, you know, my strength, my value is in the accounts, the people that I'm talking to and dealing with. And that's, you know, I don't want to overstate that. I've been in touch with people this morning already. I've set appointments. You know, you got to keep your eye on that external viewpoint. You got to go, you got to do the numbers. And if you do, as they, you know, even a blind squirrel, you know, will find a few acorns. I've met a few officers that couldn't, which has always surprised me. But if you get out there, you do the numbers, you're going to win.
Well, I think what you're also highlighting, though, is the inverse of what to do is what not to do. And I think when you look at
very good point
calendar, look at somebody's calendar for the upcoming week or month.
Yeah.
Doesn't look like there's a lot of outbound activity, meeting set up, follow up on past visits. And it looks like, you know, meeting, you know, internal task force,
right,
YZ committee, you know, ABC event.
Yeah.
That's where we just, honestly, we are creating barriers to philanthropy through, honestly, very poor calendar management. And it's not anybody's individual fault per se, but I think as leaders, we have to really provide some frameworks and guidance, and then ultimately make sure that individuals know that they need to keep their eye on that ball and also are empowered to do so.
Yeah. And this goes back to the metric stuff. And, you know, when I was at Dean Witter, I know we're running out of time, but, you know, they had our call logs. The manager would come in and say, listen, I saw you made 17 phone calls and the average duration was 9 seconds. It's not going to happen. You can't be that. That's not a complete call. It's like the telemarketing business, right? Which, you know, you look, you know, talk to Ruffalo Cody or whatever, you know, these student callers, we could learn a lot from them.
Yeah. Well, I think the future has to look a lot more like your past. There's an unbelievable warm population with affinity and capacity, and many of whom have been philanthropic in the past. So we get to lead with thank you more often than not versus hi, it's Tom from Dean Witter. And that's quite a different first impression. We are coming short on time. So I've got to give you maybe two last questions. One is, who's on your speed dial? Who are the people that, you know, when you think about other leaders in the industry, you mentioned Fritz, he came up, but who are some people that, you know, that you've really built relationships with over time?
Well, you know, I've gone up and down on those relationships. We had very good relationships when I was in the Ivy Plus group. You know, that was a tight group. I knew Fritz well at that point. Martin Schell was a contemporary. Fred Van Sickle, people at Cornell, other people, you know, Sergio Gonzalez, so at Brown now, who was at Miami when I was at Chicago. I think he's very strong. You know, there are a lot of great people in the business. So I think, and that doesn't mean just the leadership side. I mean, you know, my team here is absolutely unbelievable.
That was my next question. Tell me about your team. What are you excited about right now at Rochester? And ultimately, if folks want to get in touch and explore opportunities, how do they do that?
Well, we take a mission and values-based approach to our operation. We have a commitment to the balance between productivity and values. We try to invest very heavily in our shop from a professional development point of view, from an ethos perspective. Just trying to make sure that people like working here. It sounds easy, but it takes a lot of effort and it's dependent upon leadership, but also a lot of other things. I am blessed with a team of people who some have been here for quite a while, but they're absolutely excellent. And people care, and they want to do it. And we want to have fun while we do it, or at least enjoy it. I'm not huge on the word fun, but I'm changing a little bit. That's what we're trying to do here. And we're very mission-based. It's about education, research, public service, and healthcare, and the difference that can make in the world. And we're entering a campaign, which we're excited about because it gives us a way to, amplify our activities. And we're always looking for talent. Talent is, as you know, Brent, I mean, it's part of what you're doing here. If you had one thing you could do, it's going to be that one word. The rest of it doesn't mean anything. It's complete zero. You get go-getters, smart, ready, you're home.
Well, it makes me hopeful. I'm gonna keep thinking about your Dean Witter example because you are surrounded by talent, right? You all, the leaders that come on this show, have an unbelievable advantage relative to most firms because you are educating the talent pool of tomorrow. And I really hope we get to a spot where somebody says, maybe we're not gonna have 100 people doing training for 6 weeks at the World Trade Center, but maybe there's a future state where July 1 of every year we got 10 new
I love
trainees.
it.
We're gonna put them through the program for 6 weeks, and then they're gonna start making 100 dials a day, and it's gonna look a little bit like a mix between a traditional, student collar, except instead of it being, 5 to 9, it's gonna be 9 to 5, and then that's gonna be the talent pipeline of tomorrow. Not everybody's gonna make it, but the ones who do are gonna be incredibly well prepared. I hope we get there. I'm seeing momentum in that direction, but I know change is hard, and I hope examples like what you've shared today are an inspiration to folks that are trying to push in that direction.
Yeah, I think it's an important topic. I'd like to talk to you more about it at some point. I think the nature and status of the profession, which is not a profession, but if we could move farther towards that, I think that would be a good thing. I think that's where we are. I do want to end by thanking you, Brent. I think, I know there's a business aspect to this, and I applaud that. That's the right thing to do. But you're a very mission-based guy. You don't have to do this. And I think it's a contribution to the field. So I just want to say on behalf of, a person in the field, thank you for that. And your product is very imaginative and powerful and useful. So thank you for that as well.
Thanks, Tom. I appreciate it. It is look, it's an amazing opportunity to, as I said, a first generation college student, got to go to college because of
Love it.
philanthropy, got a window into how it works, and feel like, felt like it could be better and more effective. And
So cool.
14 years later, I still feel like it can be better, more effective, and like this
I
one
know.
maybe.
Keep doing it for us. We need it. We need
I
your
know,
creativity.
but they make me want to run through a wall because we can do it. But we can do it. So we just got to keep marching. Thank you for the kind words. And for everybody listening, don't think that it's just like I snap my fingers and I get to talk to whomever I want in the sector. I've probably been chasing Tom here for, multiple years. And so I got to practice what we're all preaching here too. And I'm so glad that I did in this case, Tom. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks a lot, Brian.
All right. Thanks, everybody. With that, I'm going to wrap today's episode featuring Tom Farrell, who serves as Senior Vice President of Advancement at the University of Rochester. Take care, everybody.